Chapter 2. Own resources, and became a man of the world at a very early age. What Mr. Howard Walker's age was at the time of the commencement of this history, and, indeed, for an indefinite period before or afterwards, it is impossible to determine. If he were 8 and 20, as he asserted himself, time had dealt hardly with him. His hair was thin, there were many crow's feet about his eyes, and other signs in his countenance of the progress of decay. If, on the contrary, he were 40, as Sam Snaffle declared, who himself had misfortunes in early life, and vowed he knew Mr. Walker in Whitecross Street Prison in 1820, he was a very young-looking person considering his age. His figure was active and slim, his leg neat, and he had not in his whiskers a single white hair. It must, however, be owned that he used Mr. Eglanton's regenerative unction, which will make your whiskers as black as your boot, and, in fact, he was a pretty constant visitor at that gentleman's emporium, dealing with him largely for soaps and articles of perfumery, which he had at an exceedingly low rate. Indeed, he was never known to pay Mr. Eglanton one single shilling for those objects of luxury, and, having them on such moderate terms, was enabled to indulge in them pretty copiously. Thus Mr. Walker was almost as great a nosegay as Mr. Eglanton himself. His handkerchief was scented with verbena, his hair with jessamine, and his coat had usually a fine perfume of cigars, which rendered his presence in a small room almost instantaneously remarkable. I have described Mr. Walker thus accurately, because, in truth, it is more with characters than with astounding events that this little history deals, and Mr. Walker is one of the principal of our dramatis personae. And so, having introduced Mr. W., we will walk over with him to Mr. Eglanton's emporium, where that gentleman is in waiting to have his likeness taken. There is about an acre of plate glass under the Royal Arms on Mr. Eglanton's shop window, and at night, when the gas is lighted, and the washballs are illuminated, and the lambent flame plays fitfully over numberless bottles of vari-colored perfumes, now flashes on a case of razors, and now lightens up a crystal vase, containing 100,000 of his patent toothbrushes, the effect of the sight may be imagined. You don't suppose that he is a creature who has those odious, simpering wax figures in his window that are called by the vulgar dummies? He is above such a wretched artifice, and it is my belief that he would as soon have his own head chopped off and placed as a trunkless decoration to his shop window as allow a dummy to figure there. On one pane you read in elegant gold letters, Glantiniot is his essence for the handkerchief. On the other is written a generative unction is his inviolable pomatum for the hair. There is no doubt about it. Eglanton's knowledge of his profession amounts to genius. He sells a cake of soap for 7 shillings, for which another man would not get a shilling, and his toothbrushes go off like wildfire at 1/2 guinea apiece. If he has to administer rouge or pearl powder to ladies, he does it with a mystery and fascination which there is no resisting, and the ladies believe there are no cosmetics like his. He gives his wares unheard of names, and obtains for them sums equally prodigious. He can dress hair, that is a fact as few men in this age can, and has been known to take £20 in a single night from as many of the first ladies of England, when ringlets were in fashion. The introduction of bands, he says, made a difference of £2,000 a year in his income, and if there is one thing in the world he hates and despises, it is a Madonna. I'm not, says he, a tradesman, I'm a artist. Mr. Eglanton was born in London, I'm a artist, and show me a fine head of hair, and I'll dress it for nothing. He vows that it was his way of dressing Mademoiselle Sontag's hair that caused the Count her husband to fall in love with her, and he has a lock of it in a brooch, and says it was the finest head he ever saw, except one, and that was Morgina Crump's. With his genius and his position in the profession, how comes it, then, that Mr. Eglanton was not a man of fortune, as many a less clever has been? If the truth must be told, he loved pleasure, and was in the hands of the Jews. He had been in business 20 years. He had borrowed £1,000 to purchase his stock and shop, and he calculated that he had paid upwards of £20,000 for the use of the £1,000, which was still as much due as on the first day when he entered business. He could show that he had received 1,000 dozen of champagne from the disinterested money dealers with whom he usually negotiated his paper. He had pictures all over his studios, which had been purchased in the same bargains. If he sold his goods at an enormous price, he paid for them at a rate almost equally exorbitant. There was not an article in his shop, but came to him through his Israelite providers. And in the very front shop itself sat a gentleman who was the nomine of one of them, and who was called Mr. Mazrus. He was there to superintend the cash account, and to see that certain installments were paid to his principals, according to certain agreements entered into between Mr. Eglanton and them. Having that sort of opinion of Mr. Mazrus which Damocles may have had of the sword which hung over his head, of course Mr. Eglanton hated his foreman profoundly. "He an artist," would the former gentleman exclaim. "Why, he's only a disguised bailiff." Mazrus indeed. "The chap's name's Amos, and he sold oranges before he came here." Mr. Mazrus, on his side, utterly despised Mr. Eglanton, and looked forward to the day when he would become the proprietor of the shop, and take Eglanton for a foreman, and then it would his turn to sneer and bully, and ride the high horse. Thus it will be seen that there was a skeleton in the great perfumer's house, as the saying is, a worm in his heart's core, and though to all appearance prosperous, he was really in an awkward position. What Mr. Eglanton's relations were with Mr. Walker may be imagined from the following dialogue which took place between the two gentlemen at 5 o'clock one summer's afternoon, when Mr. Walker, issuing from his chambers, came across to the perfumer's shop. "Is Eglanton at home, Mr. Mazrus?" said Walker to the foreman, who sat in the front shop. "Don't know, go and look," meaning go and be hanged, for Mazrus also hated Mr. Walker. "If you're uncivil, I'll break your bones, Mr. Amos," says Mr. Walker, sternly. "I should like to see you try, Mr. Hooker Walker," replies the undaunted shopman, on which the captain, looking several tremendous canings at him, walked into the back room or studio. "How are you, Tiny my buck?" says the captain. "Ach doing? Not a soul in town." "I haven't touched the irons all day," replied Mr. Eglanton, in rather a desponding way. "Well, just get them ready now, and give my whiskers a turn. I'm going to dine with Billingsgate, and some out-and-out fellows at the Regent, apostrophe and so, my lad, just do your best." "I can't," says Mr. Eglanton. "Expect ladies, Captain, every minute." "Very good. I don't want to trouble such a great man, I'm sure. Goodbye, and let me hear from you this day week, Mr. Eglanton." This day week meant that at 7 days from that time a certain bill accepted by Mr. Eglanton would be due, and presented for payment. "Don't be in such a hurry, Captain, do sit down. I'll curl you in 1 minute. And, I say, won't the party renew?" "Impossible, it's the third renewal." "But I'll make the thing handsome to you, indeed I will." "How much?" "Will £10 do the business?" "What? Offer my principal £10? Are you mad, Eglanton?" "A little more of the iron to the left whisker." "No, I meant for commission." "Well, I'll see if that will do. The party I deal with, Eglanton, has power, I know, and can defer the matter no doubt. As for me, you know, I've nothing to do in the affair, and only act as a friend between you and him. I give you my honor and soul, I do." "I know you do, my dear sir." The last two speeches were lies. The perfumer knew perfectly well that Mr. Walker would pocket the £10, but he was too easy to care for paying it, and too timid to quarrel with such a powerful friend. and he had on three different occasions already paid £10 fine for the renewal of the bill in question, all of which bonuses he knew went to his friend Mr. Walker. Here too, the reader will perceive what was, in part, the meaning of the word "gency" on Mr. Walker's door. He was a go-between between money lenders and borrowers in this world, and certain small sums always remained with him in the course of the transaction. He was an agent for wine too, an agent for places to be, at through the influence of great men. He was an agent for half a dozen theatrical people, male and female, and at the interests of the latter especially, it was said, a tart. Such were a few of the means by which this worthy gentleman contrived to support himself, and if, as he was fond of high living, gambling, and pleasures of all kinds, his revenue was not large enough for his expenditure, why, he got into debt, and settled his bills that way. He was as much at home in the Fleet as in Pall Mall, and quite as happy in the one place as in the other. That's the way I take things, would this philosopher say. If I've money, I spend. If I've credit, I borrow. If I'm dunned, I whitewash. And so you can't beat me down. Happy elasticity of temperament. I do believe that, in spite of his misfortunes and precarious position, there was no man in England whose conscience was more calm, and whose slumbers were more tranquil, than those of Captain Howard Walker. As he was sitting under the hands of Mr. Eglanton, he reverted to the ladies, whom the latter gentleman professed to expect, said he was a sly dog, a lucky ditto, and asked him if the ladies were handsome. Eglanton thought there could be no harm in telling a bouncer to a gentleman with whom he was engaged in money transactions, and so, to give the captain an idea of his solvency and the brilliancy of his future prospects, "Captain," said he, "I've got £180 out with you, which you were obliging enough to negotiate for me. Have I, or have I not, two bills out to that amount?" "Well, my good fellow, you certainly have. And what then?" "What then? Why, I bet you £5 to 1 that in 3 months those bills are paid." "Done. £5 to 1. I take it." This sudden closing with him made the perfumer rather uneasy, but he was not to pay for 3 months, and so he said, "Done. 2, and went on. "What would you say, if your bills were paid?" "Not mine, Pike's." "Well, if Pike's were paid, and the Minories man paid, and every single liability I have cleared off, and that Mazras flung out of Winder, and me and my emporium as free as air? You don't say so? Is Queen Anne dead? And has she left you a fortune, or what's the luck in the wind now? It's better than Queen Anne, or anybody dying. What should you say to seeing in that very place, where Mazras now sits, hang him? Seeing the finest head of air now in Europe? A woman, I tell you, a slap-up lovely woman, who, I'm proud to say, will soon be called Mrs. Eglanton, and will bring me £5,000 to her fortune. Well, Tiny, this is good luck indeed. I say, you'll be able to do a bill or two for me then, hey? You won't forget an old friend?" "That I won't. I shall have a place at my board for you, Captain, and many's the time I shall hope to see you under that mahogany. What will the French milliner say? She'll hang herself for despair, Eglanton." "Hush, not a word about her. I've sown all my wild oats, I tell you. Eglanton is no longer the gay young bachelor, but the sober married man. I want a heart to share the feelings of mine. I want repose. I'm not so young as I was. I feel it. Pooh, pooh. You are, well, but I sigh for an happy fireside, and I'll have it. And give up that club which you belong to, eh? The Kidneys? ?" "Of course, no married man should belong to such places. At least, I'll not, and I'll have my kidneys broiled at home. But be quiet, Captain, if you please. The lady's appointed to, and is it the lady you expect, eh, you rogue? Well, get along. It's her and her ma. but Mr. Walker determined he wouldn't get along, and would see these lovely ladies before he stirred. The operation on Mr. Walker's whiskers being concluded, he was arranging his toilet before the glass in an agreeable attitude. His neck out, his enormous pin settled in his stock to his satisfaction, his eyes complacently directed towards the reflection of his left and favorite whisker. The glanton was laid on a settee, in an easy, though melancholy posture. He was twiddling the tongs with which he had just operated on Walker with one hand, and his right hand ringlet with the other, and he was thinking of Morgina, and then of the bill which was to become due on the 16th, and then of a light blue velvet waistcoat with gold sprigs, in which he looked very killing, and so was trudging round in his little circle of loves, fears, and vanities. Ang it! Mr. Walker was thinking, I am a handsome man. A pair of whiskers like mine are not met with every day. If anybody can see that my tuft is dyed, may I be when the door was flung open, and a large lady with a curl on her forehead, yellow shawl, a green velvet bonnet with feathers, half boots, and a drab gown with tulips, and other large exotics painted on it when, in a word, Mrs. Crump and her daughter bounced into the room. Here we are, Mr. E., cries Mrs. Crump, in a gay folder confidential air. At law! There's a gent in the room. Don't mind me, ladies, said the gent alluded to, in his fascinating way. I'm a friend of a Glanton's, ain't I, egg? A chip of the old block, hey? That you are, said the perfumer, starting up. An hairdresser? Asked Mrs. Crump. I thought he was. There's something, Mr. E., in gentlemen of your profession so exceeding, so uncommon to stand ye. Madam, you do me proud, replied the gentleman so complimented, with great presence of mind. Will you allow me to try my skill upon you, or upon Miss, your lovely daughter? I'm not so clever as a Glanton, but no bad hand, I assure you. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.